Hello, it's Thursday 26th of August. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson. On today's show, Gary Bowerman of Check in Asia and I are delighted to welcome Bali-based Julia Winterflood, head writer of the Bali Beat and writer for Travel Weekly Asia, to discuss the year so far in Indonesia. So, let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So today's show is part 8 of our 2021 The Year So Far series, where we're talking to local analysts in each country of Southeast Asia. So far, we've produced an ASEAN overview and a Year So Far in Statistics show, plus country-specific editions for Singapore, Vietnam, Laos, the Philippines, and Malaysia. This week, we're heading to Indonesia to chat with Julia Winterflood, who's head writer of the Bali Beat newsletter and a travel journalist for Travel Weekly Asia. So, Julia, thanks very much for coming on the show. How are you doing today, and how are things in beautiful Bali?
Hi, Gary. Hi, Hannah. Thanks so much for welcoming me to the show. I'm really, really happy to be here. I'm a big fan of both of your work, so it's a real pleasure. Bali is beautiful and blue-skied as ever, and looking at the COVID numbers just this morning, we have had 5 days now where numbers have been steadily decreasing, so I'm feeling upbeat and quite positive this morning, but of course things, as we all know, things can change quite rapidly.
Well, that's something novel to start the show with, a little bit of optimism. So thanks for that, Julia. We've got plenty to pack into the next 30 minutes, but let's start by going back to the beginning a little bit. Julia, you were born and educated in Australia. You completed your degree in film, video and Indigenous Australian studies. So how did travel journalism and editing sort of form part of your career path?
It's a good question. They don't quite compute, do they? I had a wonderful time at university, and while I was there, I also began work as an editor of a magazine. So I've been working with words for over 12 years now. So while studying, I expanded my 3-year degree to about 7 years so I could travel in between, mostly throughout Southeast Asia and India. I found myself in Indonesia during one of those years and fell in love immediately and promised myself that I would one day live in Indonesia. So at the end of my studies, frustrated with academia, I thought, this is it, this is time for me to go out and experience the world, not just as a traveler or a spectator, but as a participant. So I joined an Australian government program called the Australian Volunteers for International Development, which brought me to Bandung in West Java in 2014. So that was an incredible year, falling deeply in love with the country of Indonesia. And after that first year in 2014, I thought, I'm just not ready to go home. And so I applied for another assignment, and that was in Bali. So working as a communications officer for a women's sexual and reproductive health clinic in Denpasar. It was actually in Bali's biggest traditional market in Denpasar. So quite an amazing place to work. So ever since then, I basically haven't gone back to Australia. I've very much made my home here. And I'm married to a Balinese now, so this will very much be my home forever.
Nice. Lucky you. So earlier this year, you became head writer of the Bali Beat newsletter, which is a publication that Gary and I really avidly follow. We really love it. And I'll drop a link to that in the show notes as well. So tell us a bit more about the publication. How have you developed the content in recent months? And what's next?
So the publication was founded by a Bostonian called Mike Shaw, who had been in Bali for a couple of years after a decade in Beijing. And at the start of the pandemic, he found it quite frustrating not being able to access enough information, local news information in English. And so he set about the very admirable task, I think, of translating a lot of the local news and then compiling it into a daily newsletter, which also included a COVID data update. So Monday to Friday, we have the morning edition, which is local news translated. And then every day in the afternoon, we have a COVID update, which has all of the data across Bali for numbers, for deaths. We do a lot of analysis with 7-day averages, etc. And it also includes the national figures. So it's really a one-stop hub of information for all things COVID, but also generally across the province, we have environmental news stories, we have political and cultural stories. So Yeah, we think it's become a great resource for people who want to go beyond the headlines, who are really keen to know what is in local media but may not be able to read Indonesian.
And a number of newsletters, some really good quality ones, have sort of pitched up during the pandemic across the region. And Hannah and I try and read as many of them as we can. But Bali Beat was probably one of the first ones which I started enjoying. I think one of the interesting things about it is, you know, Bali is known worldwide as this sort of destination, but what the Bali Beat does really, really well is to talk about, like you said, some of the cultural, societal, and some of the other machinations that have happened during COVID, and which people otherwise would just be unaware of.
Absolutely. And that's the focus, really, trying to expose all of these stories that slip through the cracks. I mean, if foreigners in particular were only reading about Bali and Indonesia in foreign media, then there's so much that can't be accessed by foreign journalists who aren't here living in the country. But I think in particular, the strongest point is that we're accessing all of these local news stories and translating them. And so there are dozens of local outlets here in Bali reporting on a whole range of things. So I've really enjoyed in particular stories on individual Balinese and how the pandemic has affected them in particular.
So let's broaden the discussion out across Indonesia. Let's look back to the start of 2021, Julia. Indonesia has struggled throughout COVID-19 for a number of reasons, which are quite well documented, to contain the virus. But at the turn of the year, were there kind of hopes that the tide might turn this year, that vaccines would help to kickstart a travel recovery?
I do believe we began the year somewhat optimistically, particularly because of the strong vaccine rollout, which began in March. So very early on, Bali was prioritized in the nation's vaccine rollout, and it is now per capita the most vaccinated province in the entire country. And it was actually a wonderful time to witness because people in the travel industry in particular were incredibly enthusiastic about receiving the vaccine. And there was great hope towards this slated July 2021 reopening of Bali. Now, as time progressed and the vaccine rollout didn't happen quite as quickly as everybody had hoped for, mostly because of international supply. I mean, if Bali had all the vaccines it could possibly manage, then absolutely the entire province would be vaccinated now. But because of that reliance on international supply, things couldn't be as quickly rolled out as quickly as we had hoped. And then, of course, moving towards Eid, the holiday at the end of Ramadan, and things began to look not so optimistic for the year, and particularly that July reopening. As you know, there were travel restrictions in place throughout the Eid holiday, but government data does show that about 1.5 million Indonesians still managed to slip through before the restrictions were in place. So a month after that is when we did see cases rise drastically in Indonesia, and add Delta into the mix. And as you said, this has been well documented. So that is when it really took a turn for the worse for the July reopening, which is obviously didn't happen. And we haven't had another date slated since.
So let's talk a little bit about domestic travel then. So that, you know, was really operating first half of the year pretty strong. And there were some international flights to and from cities like Jakarta. What happened after that? Is this purely down to this Lebaran kind of exodus?
The movement that was seen throughout that period and then combined with Delta really did mean that Indonesia was always going to struggle. It's a nation of 270 million. It's the world's biggest archipelago. Containing the virus, COVID or not, was always going to be the greatest logistical challenge that the nation has ever faced. So domestic tourism obviously did take a hit with all of the restrictions that were put in place since we have seen this spike. And so for the past month and a half, we've had a range of restrictions of varying levels. It started off with an emergency restriction that was applied in Java and Bali. And almost immediately, domestic arrivals to Bali dropped by 85%. And of course, things haven't climbed up to previous levels since then. So the restrictions have since been reduced in Java as Java's numbers have started to drop, but Bali has remained under level 4 restrictions. So this does put quite strict requirements on domestic travel. They have been eased recently to accommodate people who've been completely vaccinated. So if Indonesians have received both doses, then they only need to show an antigen test, which is much, much cheaper than the PCR test, which is required for people who've only received the first dose. So just this morning, we had an article in the Bali Beat about domestic arrivals in Bali increasing by about 10 to 15% since this reduction in requirements has been in place. And also there's been a price cap put on the PCR tests, which were among Southeast Asia's most expensive, I believe, and now they've been dropped to about 500,000 rupiah, so about $35, I believe that is. So that is it's a very slight improvement, but basically whenever there's any kind of nudge in the numbers, people do tend to get much more excited.
You mentioned the restrictions that were put in place in and around the Eid holidays, which were kind of symbolic of Indonesia's year so far, really, because it is such an important holiday period here in Malaysia as well. Just tell us a little bit more about what was happening at that time and its impact. And you mentioned that it did have an impact on Bali's reopening, but more broadly in Indonesia.
It was the beginning of a sense of there being a bit of a black cloud over the nation. The sense of foreboding of things only going to get worse was quite tangible, actually. And as you just mentioned, it's an incredibly important holiday for millions of people, in not just in the region, but in other parts of the world. And I think something to understand about the necessity of travel for some people is that many Indonesians are still unbanked. They still don't have access to a bank account. And so when their family members return once a year, that is when they're bringing home money for the family to survive for the rest of the year. So there was always a sense that people were still going to be traveling and that these restrictions weren't going to contain everybody, and that eventually that spike would return, because we did see a spike 1 month after the Christmas and New Year period. There was a rise in cases, and after that everybody just knew that things were going to go the same way again after the Eid holiday.
So how is the Indonesian travel trade coping? You know, travel agents, tour operators, hotels, have there been many closures or bankruptcies, and what kind of support is the government providing for them?
It's pretty safe to say that there have been thousands of closures of travel businesses across the country. In terms of grants, I definitely know that here in Bali, there's been quite a number of soft loans given to businesses. But these soft loans are really only to allow businesses to maintain their properties so they don't fall into disrepair. There hasn't been anything to the level of being able to retain staff, of course. So in terms of job losses, as of the end of last month, almost 80,000 people have been furloughed in Bali and 4,000 have been dismissed. So this kind of data is hard to determine accurately, because many people, of course, work informally as well. And so those numbers will always be much higher. The decline of Garuda has also been very well documented, and it recently announced that it's aiming to increase cargo to offset the dramatic drop in passenger numbers. With an airline like Garuda, which is such a source of national pride and importance, I don't believe that it'll ever fall into absolute bankruptcy, and that the Indonesian government will do what it can to rescue it. Garuda has recently appealed to the Ministry of State-Owned Enterprises to help with its debt restructuring. So I don't think at all that this will be the debt of Garuda.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. We'll come to international travel in a moment, but let's focus again a little bit on domestic travel, because as you said there, Julia, you know, Indonesia is such a huge country, a massive archipelago, a massive air sector in Indonesia. So domestic travel, like across the region, has been so important for the last 18 months. What's the current outlook, do you think, for the rest of the year?
Current outlook will very much depend on the travel regulations that are in place as part of the community activity restrictions, known as PPKM here. But I think people are still very much riding on a wave of this rediscovery of the domestic market, particularly in Bali. And I think that's a big part of what was pushing the positivity and optimism at the beginning of the year. It was quite fascinating to see the changes in this pivot from focusing on international arrivals to domestic tourists. It was quite nice to see advertising and marketing in Indonesian for the first time rather than English. And there's been a big trend in glamping, in natural tourism experiences like there has been in around the world. But there was a big focus on Jakartans, on Surabayans, and it was, people were enthusiastic. And it was quite amazing, actually, to be in resorts, to be in these spaces and be completely surrounded by Indonesian tourists. So hopefully, as the restrictions are gradually eased and also the travel requirements are eased, then perhaps that wave of enthusiasm for the domestic market will continue and carry Indonesia throughout the rest of the year.
So you mentioned one trend you've seen is glamping. Are there any other trends that you've seen that have kind of come up that are fairly new for domestic tourists?
Glamping, very much so. There's been, as we know in other parts of the world as well, there's been a big focus on kind of jazzing up certain little cafes or resorts that may feel like they need a bit of a facelift to focus on the Instagram loving clientele. That has been quite incredible, actually, just watching that there are, of course, dozens and dozens of closures, but there still have been reopenings in Bali. And I've seen little businesses like little tour buses and camper vans popping up. So it's definitely not all doom and gloom. And people have been taking these incredible risks to open businesses. But that enthusiasm and optimism I find incredibly admirable.
And Julia, tell us a little bit more about tourist villages. We hear that the Tourism and Creative Economy Minister, Sandiaga Uno, has been talking about this quite a lot as a way of stimulating domestic tourism. Tell us a little bit more about that.
This is something I find really interesting, tourism villages in Indonesia. So they're known as Desa Wisata. There's actually almost 1,800 of them registered tourism villages across the country. And as you mentioned, Sandi Uno, the tourism minister, has had a major focus of his ministry on these villages. And he's even said that they are the flagship program of the Tourism and Creative Economy Ministry. So I think that the recent focus on these villages is that people are wanting to have more of a sense of ownership over their tourism economies and making them more inclusive, but also enabling education opportunities for people within the tourism sector. Technology has been a driving force of them as well, knowing that in the future, well, even now, tourism will have much more of a dependence on technology and touchless transactions. So just trying to make the economy more accessible for people as widely as possible is a big part to play. Indonesia, of course, is home to hundreds of different cultures. And so inserting as much local culture into these locations as possible is also a priority. And also having local leaders and elders available to pass down local wisdom to visitors is also a big part of it. So it's a bit of a nebulous term and it's hard to define exactly, but I think it's very much reflective of the cultural diversity that we have across the entire archipelago, wanting to really showcase that diversity within these villages.
That's really interesting, yeah. And like you say, I've seen a lot of articles recently from the Tourism Creative Economy Ministry constantly talking about tourist villages. So we thought we have to ask you about this and what your thoughts were.
Absolutely. Yeah, like I guess, you know, we don't have much else to focus on that's entirely positive. So this has been fascinating to watch.
And so let's go back to something you were talking about earlier. So you were talking about how the government just in the past couple of weeks has set this ceiling price for antigen and RT-PCR tests. Do you see overall that this is going to be a boost to domestic tourism?
I definitely think so. The price of around 900,000, even sometimes upwards, to around 1.2 or 1.3 million rupiah, entirely prohibitive for most Indonesians. So dropping it has made a difference. And there was an instant response on social media here about people saying, okay, that's it, that's my ticket, I can actually afford it now. One interesting thing has been the fact that GNOS, the domestically developed test, is no longer in use. So this was used across all forms of travel. A very simple test and very, very cheap to manufacture at around 15,000 rupiah per test as well. So this was discontinued about a month and a half ago now due to rising concern about its accuracy. So there was actually quite a bit of backlash from the domestic tourism industry about the loss of the GNOS, knowing that it would greatly affect numbers. But it was almost unanimous that the accuracy just couldn't be accounted for.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when they launched it, I was pretty excited too, saying, oh, okay, this is really going to revolutionize things. It's so fast and it's so cheap. And then I think it was Bali who first started rejecting it, right? And saying, actually, we're not going to use this anymore as an entry proof into Indonesia.
That's correct. It was Governor Wayan Koster who finally pulled the plug on GNOS, and then generally other regions followed suit.
So, Julia, across Asia Pacific, we have this complex interplay of testing and vaccinations, but it is generally recognized that the vaccinations are central to whatever happens next in terms of travel and tourism. Indonesia took part in clinical trials for China's Sinovac way back when, and started its vaccine program, as you said earlier, you know, quite early in the piece. But it does have such a huge population, and obviously there are so many logistical challenges that go with that. What is the current vaccine situation nationwide, and where is Indonesia actually sourcing all its vaccines?
Indonesia has quite a range of vaccines in use at the moment. As you mentioned, Sinovac. It also has Moderna, Sinopharm, Pfizer and AstraZeneca. AstraZeneca was one of the primary vaccines used in Bali. We've just heard that Johnson & Johnson will arrive from next month, and also the National Drug Agency has just approved emergency use of Russia's Sputnik vaccine. So that's quite a range of vaccines there. As has been well documented, the effectiveness of Sinovac has been called into question. But I think it's really important to note that the reason why Sinovac was so widely used across Indonesia is because only Sinovac could actually fulfill the requirements of the size of Indonesia's population. So Indonesia had no choice but to go with Sinovac at that stage, knowing that it needed to desperately vaccinate as many people as possible. So in terms of rates, as of yesterday, about 60 million people across Indonesia have received the first dose. And in terms of the second dose, just over 33 million have included the second dose. As an Australian, I was very proud of Indonesia when it passed the 25 million complete vaccination marks, knowing that that's the population of Australia. I think it's an incredible achievement. In terms of Bali's vaccination rates, this is absolutely something to celebrate. Bali has a target vaccination of 70% of the population, which is just around the 3 million mark. And it's almost close to hitting the target of the first dose. It's currently at 92.45% of the first dose. And in terms of the second, just under 50% of the target. So about 5 months ago, the Bali government designated three green zones within Bali to be prioritized for vaccination. That's Nusa Dua in the south, Ubud in Gianyar, the province of Gianyar, and also Sanur. So these three tourism areas. So those areas were very much the first to approach these vaccination targets. The incredible efficiency of the vaccine rollout in Bali in particular has been something to really celebrate, I believe. And there are two driving forces behind this. The first is that the tourism industry really banded together. And the Bali Hotels Association, I think, should be commended for the role that they played. Many of their member hotels participated by providing their resorts and hotels as vaccination venues. They also assisted with the administration process and sign-ups of tourism workers. And the second reason is because of Bali's social structure here. We have something called the Banjar system, which is quite unique in Indonesia. Every Balinese person is part of their own little community unit called the Banjar. And there's about 4,500 Banjar across the province. And each of these Banjar have their own little open-air pavilion. And so these pavilions were used for the vaccine distribution. So this is, this is one of the major reasons why vaccination has been so incredibly efficient across Bali.
Yeah, I mean, agreed. I think when you look at the absolute numbers for Indonesia compared to somewhere like Singapore, and Singapore has only just reached 80%, and they've, you know, they've only got a population of about 6 million. It does make you question. And when we had Karen Yuet on the show to talk about Singapore a few weeks ago, we did ask, there's a big difference. Why is Singapore so comparatively slow? But, you know, you're right. I think a lot of it comes down to supply and not having much choice about what you've got. So you've got to use what you've got. But certainly Indonesia is doing well. When are they slated to finish?
Slated to finish by, I should have checked that. I do believe it's by the end of next year. It's a target of 208 million people in total, which is staggering when you really think about what is involved logistically, especially with the more remote regions of the archipelago where access to testing and health centres are obviously limited. You can just think about all of these vaccines being delivered by boat to some islands because, of course, they wouldn't have flight access. So it is. It's absolutely the Jakarta Globe noted that it's the biggest logistical challenge in the nation's history.
There are two factors. Like you said, it's the fourth most populous nation in the world. But it's the logistics, the geographical logistics of being such a huge archipelago that make this just an immense challenge.
Absolutely. There are still many areas of the archipelago that aren't electrified. They don't have access to electricity as well. So all of these factors combine to make it an incredible task. But I think there have been many, many faults and flaws in the Indonesian government's handling of the pandemic, but vaccinations, definitely not one of them.
So we can't have you on the show without talking about Bali reopening. There was so much in the press, like you said earlier in the year, about Bali reopening to a lesser extent, Lombok, Batam and Bintan. Do you think a reopening is going to be likely for Bali in 2021?
Absolutely, the trillion rupiah question. We haven't had any media reports of potential reopening since the community activity restrictions were enforced at the beginning of July. And during the press conference when those restrictions were announced, there was a very telling moment when the coordinating minister for maritime affairs and investment, Minister Luhut Binsar Panjaitan, who is in charge of handling COVID in 9 regions, including Java and Bali. So a journalist asked him, Pak Luhut, when will Bali reopen? And Luhut's only response was that the nation is currently entirely focused on reducing COVID numbers and vaccinating as many as possible. And that was his only response. And so since then, reopening has really drifted from the agenda, from the headlines. It's been quite a few weeks since any mention of it, substantial mention of it has emerged. Things may change over the next few months, especially as Bali approaches its 70% vaccination target and numbers do drop elsewhere in the country. But I mean, currently with the PPKM restrictions, foreigners without a permanent or temporary stay or diplomatic visa aren't even allowed entry into the country, let alone tourist arrivals. So it is, of course, difficult to say, and I'm never going to say anything concrete about something so vague. But I think over the next month, we may see a sense of a rise in optimism about reopening.
And when tourism does come back into the fold, there's been a lot of talk, not just in Indonesia, but across the region, about different forms of tourism. We hear more about sustainable tourism, green tourism, all these kinds of things. But the tourism ministry in Indonesia has said specifically a few times that it's looking to move away from mass tourism, which is controversial, particularly for the tourism industry, which relies on that or did through over recent years. Is that really a possibility for Indonesia?
It's a really difficult question. And I think the thing to really preface any conversation about the shift from mass tourism would be, I do believe it's going to be many, many years until the nation and travel more generally approaches levels of mass tourism numbers. But here in Bali, it was interesting to watch there was a very definite shift in the conversation. Sustainable tourism has been the buzzword for the past 20 years in Bali. But gradually, sustainable tourism shifted to quality tourism. The focus was then on quality tourism. And generally speaking, the government would define a quality tourist as somebody who stays for much, much longer and of course injects more money into the economy at different along different areas. So not those who are arriving as a package tourist per se, say, and only staying in one resort, staying for 2 to 3 days and only visiting establishments per a set schedule. I do feel that there was a sense that people were wanting to move away from that kind of tourism. But at the moment, with virtually no international arrivals, it's difficult to have a concrete conversation about anything. Everything is still extremely vague in terms of these concepts. I mean, it'd make more sense to have this conversation in 2 years' time, I think. At the moment, of course, people just want anybody, no matter what kind of tourist they are.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, it's one thing for policymakers to say this kind of thing, but it's entirely differently to reshape an entire tourism industry on that basis. You know, it's not just in Southeast Asia, it's around the world. We've gone from over-tourism to zero-tourism, and everybody is really trying to work out what happens next. But I just don't think it is particularly helpful for anybody to start making these categorizations or these prognoses, which, as you say, Julia, we have no idea what's going to happen in the next 3 to 5, even 10 years in the region, in travel tourism, in economics, in societies. It just seems a little bit premature.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. One thing that has been encouraging is I've spoken to quite a number of young Balinese in particular who recall the numbers that Bali was receiving prior to the pandemic, and they would speak of the traffic jams that were affecting the narrow streets of Ubud and the fact that it would take sometimes up to 3 hours to travel from the east to the south. And despite the impact, the devastating impact that it has had economically, these young Balinese in particular, they didn't want their island to return to what it was before. So I do take some sense of positivity from their sentiments. But of course, these are young people. They may not necessarily have families to feed. So that's what it's going to come down to at the end of the day, how people are actually going to be able to continue to support themselves. I mean, this kind of change, I don't believe a pandemic can even achieve. This takes generations of people to approach tourism differently. The pandemic has been the past 2 years, let's say another 5 to 10 years to make a genuine shift. And we can see this across the island. There are still resorts popping up. There's still a lot of construction. These kind of projects haven't slowed. There's even been, we had a story in the Beat about a month ago, Southeast Asia's largest theme park has been slated to be built in Bali. And that, of course, you would assume would bring in somebody that could be considered part of mass tourism. So it's hard to see genuine concrete change at the moment, but I'm still encouraged by those conversations that I have with young Balinese about what they want for the future of their tourism industry.
And to tap you for some more optimism then. So as a travel journalist, you've written several articles about Indonesia and other Southeast Asian countries in recent months. Have you found anything that gives you hope and inspiration for the months ahead, maybe the years ahead?
One thing that always dazzles me and impresses me, and one thing that I find just so incredibly humbling, is despite how devastated the industry has been in this region, people still harbour hope. And it may not necessarily be anything concrete, but I'll always remember a particular line from an interviewee that I spoke with about a year ago now, actually, in Lavina, when I was reporting for Travel Fish, the Southeast Asia travel guide. I spoke to a young manager of a resort in Lavina, very much old style Bali, one of those very relaxed, old charming resorts. And he said, "We really have no hope for tourism anymore, but that doesn't mean we have no hope." And I really clung to that as a sense of just how hopeful and optimistic people are still able to remain. And I've seen that in reporting across Southeast Asia. I've recently been focusing on the Philippines. And as we know, COVID has impacted the Philippines terribly. But the big part of it for me is that people haven't given up. They want to get their vaccination. They want to implement as many safety and health protocols as possible. They're not jumping ship. They still feel like they have a future in tourism. So that has always been a driving sense of optimism for me.
That's great to hear, Julia. And it's been fantastic to talk to you. And finally to talk to you, the three of us have WhatsApped and we've emailed so many times over recent months, but it's great to actually to talk. And before we go, we've got one more question for you. And during the pandemic, you actually traveled back to Australia, took a little bit of time out. But when the borders do reopen properly, where's on your bucket list?
I would really like to go, as would my husband, to Penang. I've never travelled in that part of the region before, and I think I just absolutely go crazy for the food and the architecture, of course, and it's not too far away. So I think that's where we'll be heading when we can finally make it out of Indonesia.
Fabulous. We'll see you there.
Great. Would love that very much.
So, Julia, where can our listeners find you?
Listeners can find me on Twitter. My handle is at jwinterflood. I also have a personal website, jwinterflood.com. But please do subscribe to the Bali Beat if you're interested in all things Bali and Indonesia as well. We definitely do contain a lot of stories about the region.
And I'll drop that in the show notes as well. Definitely, everyone go subscribe to that one. So thank you so much, Julia, for coming on. Gary and I have really enjoyed our conversation and the updates about what's going on in Bali.
Thank you both so much. It's a real pleasure. And I'm absolutely honoured to have been part of your show this morning.
Thank you. So that brings us to the end of today's Indonesia the Year So Far special edition of the show. We hope you enjoyed the podcast, and don't forget to send us your thoughts and comments on what we discussed with Julia or what we missed out. Drop us an email at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com, or you can message us on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show, or Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Yep, meanwhile, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, Castbox, Overcast, Podcast Addict, Stitcher, and Amazon Music. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each app. And please remember, if you do listen to us on Apple Podcasts, if you could rate and review us, that would be great, because it helps other people to find the show.
So that's a wrap for today, and we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you very soon.